Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 22, Hot Stuff. In this episode, we start examining the founding of physical chemistry with a look first at heat. Physical chemistry has a special place for me because that was my graduate studies and research. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. We already saw in the middle of the 18th century how Joseph Black began the study of thermodynamics, or movement of heat, with his discovery of latent heat. But research into heat continued in earnest over the next century. Another founding member of the Thermodynamics Club was that American traitor, Benjamin Thompson, Count Rumford, who became the second husband of Marie Anne Lavoisier. During the Revolutionary War, he was working for the British on the force from gunpowder. After he fled to Britain and then worked in Bavaria, he continued his research, looking at materials that act as insulators to heat. On a culinary note, Thompson was the inventor of the sous vide cooking method, that is, low-temperature cooking in a container sealed away from the heat. But Count Rumford is best known for his paper entitled An Experimental Inquiry Concerning the Source of the Heat Which is Excited by Friction, published in 1798. He bored out the tube in a cannon and measured the heat generated, and thus showed that work, drilling, is equivalent to heat. We have also mentioned Dulong and Petit's research on specific heats of elements being related to atomic weights. Over the course of more research, scientists, we can now use the term instead of natural philosophers, realized that there seemed to be a law of conservation of energy. That is, the amount of energy is constant, though it can be converted into different forms. We now call this law of conservation of energy the first law of thermodynamics. More research showed that heat always flows from hot objects to colder ones, and never the opposite direction. In 1850, Rudolf Clausius, whom we met briefly earlier, invented an idea which he called entropy, Greek, inside transformation, which was the ratio of the amount of heat of an isolated system to its absolute temperature. Another way to view entropy is the amount of disorder of the isolated system. Of course, disorder implies some kind of microscopic particles that get out of order. And Clausius, as I mentioned in the previous episode, found out by 1857 that some molecules do break into positive and negative parts. For Clausius, a physicist, the idea of entropy was used in an example of physical change, that of expanding a gas into a vacuum, which will happen spontaneously. The temperature is the same after expansion, but entropy rises. There is more disorder. But then you have to do work on the gas to squeeze it back into the container. Entropy has risen in the universe, and you can't undo that. What about the phrase isolated system? In an ideal world, we can wall off some experiment from the rest of everything and call that an isolated system. Many experiments approximate that, but another view is that an isolated system actually is everything, that is, the universe. What Clausius showed is that whenever energy changes in a system spontaneously, the entropy always increases. We now call this the second law of thermodynamics. Clausius worded these two laws this way. Die Energie der Welt ist konstant. Die Entropie der Welt strebt einem Maximum zu. Or, in English, the energy of the universe is constant. The entropy of the universe tends toward a maximum. So how do these laws of thermodynamics affect chemistry? Well, even in the early 19th century, chemists knew that some chemical reactions create heat. If you burn anything, such as coal or wood, that creates heat. By this time, chemists also knew that if you mix an acid and base in a neutralization reaction, that also evolves heat. Evidently, chemists had to learn how to apply the knowledge of thermodynamics to reactions. A German chemist, August Horstmann, who, by the way, worked under Clausius, looked mathematically at what happens to entropy if you separate hydrogen chloride into its elements, hydrogen and chlorine. He commented, "It is 1, decreased by the conversion of heat into chemical work, 2, increased through the greater distance between the atoms of the decomposed molecule, 3, increased because the remaining undecomposed molecules have to move farther apart to fill the same space, 4, and 5, decreased as the number of molecules of the two products of decomposition increases, and these molecules are thus crowded together. The entropy will then be greatest when as many molecules as possible are decomposed, but as little as possible heat is consumed, and when, besides, the molecules of each of the three gases are removed as far as possible from one another." The Swiss-Russian chemist who was a student of Berzelius, Henri Hess, in 1840 decided to do really careful measurements of these heats of reaction to determine exactly how much heat was emitted or absorbed. The modern technical name, coined by the Dutch scientist Kamerlingh Onnes in the 1920s, for a heat of reaction is enthalpy, which comes from Greek in plus to warm. He researched chemical events such as mixing water and sulfuric acid, acid-base neutralizations, synthesizing zinc and lead sulfate in various ways, and more. He discovered that if you chemically transform one substance into another, it doesn't matter what or how many steps you took. The amount of heat transfer is the same. The only thing that matters is the starting materials and the final products. We now call this Hess's law, and often he is considered the founder of thermochemistry. The existence of this law indicates that the law of conservation of energy works for chemistry too, and most likely the second law about entropy increasing in an isolated system also applies. The problem is how to measure entropy. There is no such item or machine as an entropy meter. So chemists tried to substitute other indirect methods to figure out entropy changes, such as finding what is the driving force of a reaction, that is, what makes a reaction go. And ultimately, this problem is related to that vague idea of chemical affinity I have discussed in previous episodes, or what makes some atoms stick to each other and others not. Some people not versed in thermodynamics often blather on about how these laws of thermodynamics disallow the spontaneous creation of life on Earth several billion years ago. They might say something like, "Entropy must increase, but life is very organized with low entropy, so how could life happen?" This is a form of pseudoscience couched in jargon. The laws of thermodynamics do not disallow life to form. Note that the laws include the phrase isolated system. Life can start, and entropy can decrease spontaneously in that particular zone inside a cell, but must increase everywhere else, such as the pond or oceanside or tide pool or wet clay or wherever biologists now theorize the first primitive life emerged. Life takes in matter and energy, metabolizes them chemically to continue the local decrease in entropy, and emits waste products which have a higher amount of disorder, such as gas molecules, increasing the entropy outside of its cells. Life still follows the laws of thermodynamics. No known exceptions to the laws of thermodynamics have ever been found, and the existence of life does not break the laws of thermodynamics. The science fiction writer and science writer Isaac Asimov wrote a very famous short story in 1956 called The Last Question, in which one of the main characters, or at least is certainly the theme, is the gradual and eternal increase in entropy throughout the universe with time, and how to reverse that. I don't want to spoil the story for you, so find a copy and read it. Asimov himself said that this is by far my favorite story of all those I have written. The story was even adapted in the early years of non-astronomical shows for planetariums around North America, where I was captivated as a child by the story in the Fells Planetarium at the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia in 1973. By the way, Asimov's education included a doctorate in biochemistry, although he admitted he wasn't a very good scientist. Two chemists simultaneously built boxes, or calorimeters, to measure accurately heat transfers. One of the chemists was Berthelot, whom we met in organic chemistry for synthesis. But now, in the 1860s, Berthelot's calorimeter was a canister with the sample sealed inside, immersed in a bath of water held at a particular temperature. He could remotely start the reaction and measure the temperature of the water at the end of the reaction. From the quantity of water and the change in temperature, you can calculate the amount of heat a reaction generated. The other chemist was Julius Thomson of Denmark, who independently did similar experiments. A modern calorimetry experiment that you might encounter in an undergraduate physical chemistry laboratory includes a heavy-duty steel can with a screw-on steel lid. To prepare your sample for combustion, you grind up your sample of known weight into a powder, lay a thin fuse wire into the powder, and compress the mixture and wire together so that you can connect the fuse wire to electrical contacts on the lid. You hang the sample by wires from the lid, screw on the lid, and seal the can. The can is technically called a bomb because then you attach electrical contacts to a remote power supply and immerse the can in a controlled temperature water bath. Then you switch on the electricity, the current heats the wire and ignites the sample inside the bomb, and the heat of reaction leaks out and warms the water bath. You measure the new temperature of the water bath and calculate the heat of reaction, the enthalpy, for your known amount of sample. The whole system is called a bomb calorimeter. From the results, Berthelot concluded that spontaneous reactions all evolved heat, and non-spontaneous reactions didn't evolve heat. If you reverse a heat-evolving reaction, it will absorb heat, but then it seems that there is only one direction for such a reaction, to evolve heat, and that is the direction a reaction will go spontaneously. So, if you spark hydrogen with oxygen to make water, you also get a lot of heat, and that's the spontaneous direction. You never see water decomposing spontaneously to give hydrogen and oxygen, and cooling off in the process. The only way to decompose water is to add extra energy as heat or electricity to get the reverse reaction to go. It turns out that Berthelot was wrong. There are some known reactions that absorb heat, but are spontaneous. For example, mixing baking soda with vinegar or hydrochloric acid is a spontaneous reaction, but cools down. A second type of reaction is a reversible reaction. In this case, imagine two chemicals A and B. They react to form products C and D. But also, C and D can react to form A and B. A known case is hydrogen iodide, which breaks apart into hydrogen gas and iodine. But the hydrogen and iodine also simultaneously recombine to make hydrogen iodide. Our friend and mentor to the Choshu Five, Alexander Williamson, also described reversible reactions in 1850. To use our immediate example, he ran a reaction of starting reactants A and B, and the result was that he found products C and D. He also started with reactants C and D, and found products A and B. In both experiments, he ended up with a mixture of A, B, C, and D, with particular concentrations of each after a certain amount of time. The resultant mixture was apparently at equilibrium. But Williamson hypothesized that even though some kind of endpoint mixture came out, it wasn't a static mixture. There was constant chemistry going on at the molecular level. A and B were always making C and D, but the C and D were simultaneously making A and B. Each direction was canceling the opposite reaction out, so that what appeared to be static was actually a dynamic equilibrium. As Williamson himself wrote, "For an aggregate of the molecules of every compound, a constant interchange between the elements contained in them is taking place." Now, Williamson wrote this shortly before Kekulé had created molecular structures on paper, so it sounds, at least to me, that Williamson had in mind a sort of grab bag of atoms wandering around without regard to molecules or how molecules were built. But at least he was on the right track. Alexander Williamson's research thus founded what we now call chemical kinetics, which is chemistry of the rates of reactions. Clearly, something else beyond making heat was necessary to describe if a chemical reaction was spontaneous. Another anecdote about Isaac Asimov, his 1948 doctoral dissertation at Columbia University was on chemical kinetics of a biological molecule called tyrosinase, a plant-based enzyme. His research was published in the Journal of the American Chemical Society in 1950. Another important bit of data came about through Ferdinand Wilhelmy's research published also in 1850 on cane sugar, also called sucrose. If you dissolve sucrose in water, it is optically active. It rotates polarized light clockwise. If you put acid into that sugar water solution, the acid causes the sucrose to break apart into two smaller sugars. You can follow the reaction in real time by watching how much rotation polarized light undergoes. Wilhelmy did this and deduced that the concentration of the sucrose affects how fast the reaction runs, and wrote it mathematically as a differential equation. This use of math was unfamiliar to most chemists at the time. Wilhelmy had devised the first quantitative experiment in chemical kinetics. Then, in 1862, Berthelot and a colleague, Léon Saint-Gilles, examined how ethanol and acetic acid reacted to form ethyl ethanoate and water. Here the scientists realized also that rate of reaction was proportional to the concentrations of both ethanol and acetic acid. But also, let's use generalized symbols A, B, C, and D. Here, A is ethanol, B is acetic acid, C is ethyl ethanoate, and D is water. Keep this alphabet soup in mind, for here comes the generalized rule. Two brothers-in-law, Norwegian chemist Peter Vage and chemist-mathematician Cato Guldberg, had heard of some of this kinetic research, and in 1863 suggested that a reaction's progress had to do with the mass of the individual compounds in the reaction. But they noted that mass wasn't the full story. It really was the concentration, as we just heard above, that is, how much mass is jammed into a particular volume. That was the key. So let's use our A, B, C, D symbols for imaginary reactants and products again. A real-life example is A for potassium sulfate, B for barium carbonate, C for potassium carbonate, and D for barium sulfate if you like inorganic compounds. And A is ethanol, B is acetic acid, C is ethyl ethanoate, and D is water for organic compounds. But it's easier for me to say A, B, C, and D. A and B react to give C and D, and simultaneously C and D react to give A and B. You can write it as A plus B, forward and back arrows, C plus D, where a double arrow pointing in two directions, left and right, shows a reversible reaction. We know from Williamson's research that there will be some final equilibrium where some particular concentrations of A, B, C, and D are reached. That point, however, depends on the rate of the forward reaction and how likely A and B react, as well as the rate of the reverse reaction and how likely C and D react. Let's say that the forward rate is much faster than the reverse rate. So A and B react fast, making a lot of C and D. Simultaneously, C and D react, but slowly, making only a little A and B. So most of what we measure in the mixture is C and D, and just a little of A and B. We can say that the equilibrium point is mostly to the right side of the equation. Now, let's say that the reverse rate is faster than the forward rate. A and B react slowly, making only a little C and D. Simultaneously, C and D react fast, making a lot of A and B. So in the final equilibrium mixture, we will see mostly A and B, and much less C and D. We say that the equilibrium is toward the left of the equation. But, assuming molecules exist, we know that the forward rate A reacts with B depends on how often A bumps into B, and the reverse rate C reacts with D depends on how often C bumps into D. Now let's imagine a container, and we add more A or B or both to it. There is a fixed volume, so A's and B's concentrations rise. Likewise, the rate at which A collides with B increases when you add more A or B or both to the mixture. In sum, if you add A or B, you increase the forward rate of reaction. If you add C or D, you increase the reverse rate of reaction. Therefore, you can change the equilibrium point of the mixture by changing concentrations of any of the reactants. But Vaga and Guldberg found one constant in all this changing. That is, multiply the concentration of A times the concentration of B. Take that product and divide it by the concentration of C times the concentration of D. That whole mess is a constant at a particular temperature. We call this value capital K, or the equilibrium constant. Guldberg's and Vaga's discovery is now called the law of mass action, and it helps immeasurably in interpreting how reversible reactions work. The problem is that they published their work in the Norwegian language, which wasn't and isn't an international language of science like English, French, or German. So it was ignored till it was translated into German in 1879 and republished. But the equilibrium constant has become a mainstay of kinetics in the world of chemistry ever since, and we shall see it appear in future episodes. I quoted August Horstmann as to the entropy changes when HCl is deposed into H and Cl. I left off the last sentence of the quote. Here is his second paragraph with the rest of the thought. The entropy will then be greatest when as many molecules as possible are decomposed, but as little as possible heat is consumed, and when, besides, the molecules of each of the three gases are removed as far as possible from one another. In general, this cannot occur at complete decomposition. Therefore, only a part is decomposed. Horstmann therefore connected Clausius's entropy with reversible reactions that go only part way toward products. And this is why reversible reactions can have a measurable mix of reactants and products in the same stew. In our next episode, we continue down the path of physical chemistry, looking at gases again, plus Faraday's mysterious ions in solution. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.